It was a pouring, dreadful night, and I was down on the docks of Barcelona looking for a ship. And in the car was all my photographic equipment, my little dog Flipper, and myself. And having finally found the ship, spent the rest of the night on a deck heaving and rolling with rain. And then as the morning came, the light came up, the sea calmed, and quite like a celestial vision, an island, all green with white houses, began to appear on the horizon. And as we came closer, the hills with their voluptuous convolutions, and the old town on the left with the cathedral on top and its enormous clock never kept the right time, all presaged something wonderful was about to happen. The whole town had turned out to meet the ship, and suddenly Flipper appeared, and he barked hello to everybody, and the whole place went mad.
And Ibiza began for you and Flipper, didn't it?
And that was my introduction.
Lovely. To Ibiza. To paradise.
What song did the sirens sing on their enchanted island? What irresistible music lured sailors into the sea to swim towards a mirage? Somehow I don't think it was Banging House. I know that's not what I heard back in the mid-60s when I went on holiday to an unknown Balearic island called Ibiza. I meant to stay for a week. I ended up living there for a year. I wasn't the only voluntary shipwreck of those times. There were others, too, expatriates and dropouts, some in flight, some in search of paradise. A few have remained. Even now, Ibiza has become a brand name for riot and rave culture. How good it is to return after all these decades and find there are still pockets of recollected magic.
We're standing outside the walls of the upper city, the real old city of Ibiza. The walls will stay, I hope, forever and not change. But the landscaping has changed, because in my day, at the end of the walls was the beginning of nature. Walled cities keep things out, and they also lock things in. Hello, how good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Oh.
Good morning, Clyde.
Isn't this a surprise?
Yes, absolutely. A surprise.
This is really astonishing. I'm sitting between the two most famous barmen in the Mediterranean.
Both sober.
I should know. Wherever you go, you hear about Sandy's Bar.
Yeah.
If you mention Ibiza to anyone who knew Ibiza in the days.
We were very lucky. And Clive was very lucky, and I was very lucky to have struck it at that moment. I think the whole of Europe was going through a wonderful period. The war was over, and everyone was looking forward to meeting new people and getting out away from all the awful scenes there had been, and everything was idyllic.
Sandy's, I think, was an outpost and a place where people who lived in and around Santa Eulalia used to collect post and use your phone. And
absolutely. I had the telephone, so if there was anything really serious, they would get in touch.
So it was more like a parish, really, people who came to a bar.
Yes.
The Domino was the first bar, the only bar you saw when you got off the ship, came in.
Domino was the dive. It was already below sea level, so the toilets in there were abysmal. And the police used to try and close us. And we used to say, well, if you're looking for any bandits or any, they're in there. If you close it, they're going to go somewhere else.
That's a true barman still thinking.
There was this fat Canadian, McDonald. He'd lie on his back and he'd have his rum and coke on his fat stomach. And we'd leave him there at night. We'd close at 2 o'clock and leave him there. Still be there in the morning.
Well, in the Domino, the music that I remember, because though I was a New Yorker, I'd never really heard cool jazz before.
Miles Davis, etc., etc. Yeah.
And jokes, you know, fun.
Was it relatively innocent, do you think?
Yes, I think it's a very good expression.
I got off the boat from Barcelona, and I think I fell in love even before I saw the man standing there, the stranger who became a lover and friend for a long time. It was my great love affair, yeah, the love affair with Douglas whom I met here. We're going to see Edith Sommer, who's a Swiss-born artist who's been living here on Ibiza for yonks, since the 60s, and shows her paintings pretty much all over Europe.
In the beginning, when I came, naturally, like everybody, I drank too much. And Ivan Spence, the crazy Englishman who has a gallery there, Ivan said, "You bring me new paintings." I said, "No, you know, I must first adapt myself to the island, so on." Ivan said, "Okay, come back in a week, but with paintings." I came back in a week. He said, "You have paintings?" I said, "No." He said, "You know what? You start not to interest me anymore as a personality. You came here to the island, and you know life is challenge and response, and your response is bullshit. So please don't come here, or you come with new paintings." And that sentence stayed in my head until today, challenge and response.
The island has changed. I mean, or it looks this way to me. I haven't been back for
long. The island has changed completely. There was no telephone. I lived 8 years without electricity.
But it looked like paradise to you, almost on arrival.
It was paradise because when I was 28, things like this are fun.
What do you think it was we were looking for?
Well, I guess it was in a way that there was not a sort of establishment. Everybody could do what they wanted as long as they didn't harm anybody.
What you're talking about is a kind of freedom to express mm-hmm. yourself?
I think the only thing we had to do, if you gave a party for more than 10 people, you had to tell it to the police.
It's interesting to come to a place that attracted so many artistic and really interesting people of their time. People who were perhaps in flight from something at home. In my case, the Westchester husband and the two cars. But also looking for a creative way of life. But it wasn't just to rave. It was to do something, to make something beautiful.
That's us.
We live between the cemetery and the prison.
Very useful. I know a New Yorker when I hear one.
Oh, it's cool and lovely. Ooh, I feel as if I've been here before.
I'm sure you have. There we are. I was at that time a neophyte photographer, and my second wife had just been forced out of the New York City school system by McCarthyism.
Harold Lebo.
And was the tail end of the competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. And when Sputnik went up, America went mad engineering-wise. Yeah. And the government began to subsidize some of the publishers and the universities to reactivate the humanistic studies in America. And they wanted a social studies book on how children in Europe lived. In Ibiza, the book I did was on a farmer's family. And the difference between absolute dependence on the goodwill of the police rather than the law is an enormous difference psychologically. It's a different world. It was the only real negative for me, but I was able to get around it because in those days, the compelling social ambience of the original Ibisinkos, which was so permissive and so democratic by in instinct and so wonderfully welcoming and warm, I had no compunction at all at the end of 3 or 4 days to say, yes, this is what I want to do. And it changed my whole life. When I first got here, you could buy a cup of coffee for 5 pesetas, and they used to sell cigarettes individually.
You had to lick the paper and glue them together yourself. Did you used to eat it? Was it Juanitos on the front?
Juanito was a, he looked like a Frankenstein from a distance, but he had a wonderful personality. And the most wonderful thing about him was his chicken.
I always remember him when I'd want the chicken, but for some reason it was all, probably you'd been there and bought it all out. I can remember him saying, but ay hígado, there's liver, which is not ay hígado.
Martin Davis, and I'm a, like an Ibithologist, is what I call myself.
As many of the people who came here a long time ago, especially and settled here, and perhaps some of the Ibithencos too, think of the current Ibiza scene as a kind of invasion. I was curious to know about the history of this island in terms of its having been invaded in the past.
There were invasions, but then there were long periods of settlement with no one invading. And the last invasion before the touristic invasion was in 1235, so it had 7 centuries of non-invasion for the Ibithencos.
It's a relatively long time, a period
exactly.
of peace.
Yeah, there were incursions by pirates from North Africa over that period, so it was a very peaceful and neglected island, yeah.
To live in a different country, of course, to expatriate yourself from your own country,
yeah.
you're getting away from things too.
I suppose you are.
How yeah. much of it is flight, sir?
A lot, a great deal.
Escaping from certain puritanical, rigid rules.
Absolutely. Sometime in the 60s, when all the people in fancy dress, everybody in fancy dress, including myself a bit, one always would put on something exotic.
I don't remember an active gay scene here, but I suppose there must have been.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Because there wasn't one on the mainland at that time. It was still verboten in most of Europe, you know.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no.
Must have known Terry Thomas.
Terry was a great character. Terry had this extraordinary, very blatant motor car, which was painted with little flowers all over it, and which was to match a shirt he had. He liked making a scene.
I am not on the telephone in Ibiza, and I like that tremendously. And it's just another world for me, and I can develop another side to me. I can paint, and at least I wish I could paint, but I can try and paint and write and do all sorts of things. And another thing is that I don't speak Spanish, so I can't be bored by anybody.
Terry Thomas, thank you.
Oh, delighted. Goodbye.
I was swimming from the rocks one day, and I had waiting for me in my bag a letter from my mother. And it said, "It looks as if our shining hope has become just another Mediterranean beach bomb." It hurt so much, that letter, and at the same time I remember thinking, why didn't somebody tell me I was a shining hope? I'm on my way to meet Cesar Jerez Ferreira, who's from a traditional island family.
My family, we were farmers. It was fantastic. Time has too much value now. Before, time was no value, it was great.
And what about money?
Money wasn't that important, because our farm, we were cultivating just enough to survive.
Were there many friends, many families together?
We were all together. We were friends, because all the farmers, we used to help each other. And also, it was a party. When you take the maize off the corn.
The corn.
Yeah, it was a party. You know, all the neighbors around our farm was coming home and was eating and drinking till 3 or 4 in the morning, and it was good parties.
Did you go into school in Ibiza time?
No, I went to school in Santa Eulalia. It was under the Franco, the dictator. And Franco, it was easier for him to run the country with the innocent people. So we learned actually the basics, and then we started work very young.
The foreigners started coming here when?
The 60s.
Were they aware of Franco?
Yeah. You couldn't wear a mini skirt. They pick you up and they take you to the hotel and please put a long dress on.
And there were things you couldn't say?
Of course. It wasn't a free country.
And books you couldn't read?
Books we couldn't read, yeah. My first business was import pornography from England. It was fantastic business. Because here you couldn't see a woman naked. It was not allowed.
I find it astonishing, then, that tourists arrived here at all, or were even permitted to come, because they would bring ideas that were seditious.
Yeah, but we need the tourists, we need the money. because after the Civil War, Spain was very, very poor. And I think Franco was a very hard man, but he wasn't stupid at all. For instance, my grandmother, in 1930, she swapped a mule, not even a horse, with a carriage for 200,000 square meters of land in Formentera, quarter of an island. It was incredible. It became a very rich one.
Just from a mule and a cart swapped for land at the right time.
Once I remember talking to a fisherman, and just the two of us in this restaurant, he said change times to me, and I said yes, change times, and I'm not for the better.
Sandy Pratt from Sandy's Bar.
And he turned on me and he said, how can you say that? He said, you know, it's wonderful. It's wonderful for my children, wonderful for my grandchildren. He said, you don't remember and you didn't know what it was like to be here in the poverty.
You're among the few who came in that period, it seems to me, who didn't decide to make art.
Make?
You know, write the great novel, paint the great picture.
I've done it three times.
What, written the great novel?
Yes. Put it away.
Exactly. I did exactly the same. I decided that would be just the place to do it, and of course I never did anything. We're all meant to be doing it. If we weren't doing it, all the others were. So someone would eventually take up the...
Someone made, got famous out of it.
Who got famous out of it?
Clifford Irving.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never understood the Clifford Irving story.
He forged Howard Hughes.
The story of Howard Hughes' life.
Yes, exactly.
He knew Hughes and he didn't. He never met him.
Artist Edith Summer was married to Clifford Irving.
He had just a contract with his publishers for $450,000. And he wanted to travel and go away with his love, Nina Palland. And when he started doing it, he said, this will make me forget Nina and you have to help me. And in a way, a very dramatical ending of our love affair. And in the end, I knew from beginning he was a womanizer. And he married about seven times.
I mean, obviously he and Mr. Hughes had quite a bit in common.
Yeah, that might be too, yeah.
What I couldn't understand is why it was considered what they did as so...
heinous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So wasn't it to do with Czechs and Switzerland and...
The fuss was about money.
Yeah.
Did Edith actually go to prison for that scam?
Yes, she did.
In Spain?
In Switzerland.
Well, she told me she was going to do it because she wanted to be able to go wherever she wanted to go, whenever. So she wiped the slate clean.
Considering... the innocence of the time, there was quite a bit of forgery and fibbing going on around Ibiza, because there was Elmir was here
Elmir,
then.
Yeah.
He used to come to the bar a lot.
Elmir de Hoy was my best friend when I came here.
Oh, I met him once. Yeah. He was a gifted man, actually.
And very, very funny. He was one of the biggest art fakers.
You have any of his paintings?
No, I never. First of all, none of us knew until it came out.
He was a very celebrated art faker, and like some art fakers, probably almost as gifted as some of the people he faked.
The expert of Dufy in Paris said he had seen so many Elmirs that in the end he took the real Elmirs for real and the real Dufys for not Dufys, because he thought they were not as good as Elmirs.
I went to see him on Sunday, and he was looking very disheveled, unshaven, very unusual for Elmir. And he had been told that the police, they were going to ask for his extradition. He had told me that he would kill himself. And then here's why I kicked myself, because he took these pills and all the rest of it, and I didn't go back that week.
There was no way you could have stopped that, Sandy. He was determined. It's astonishing how oblivious to politics most of us foreigners were on Ibiza. Franco had a steel grip on Spain. His informants were in Ibiza, too. Among us were refugees from McCarthyism in the US and later from the conflict in Vietnam. For the most part, however, we islanders of the 60s made words and pictures, and we made a little trouble, but mainly we made love, not war. I'm sitting in one of the beautiful and timeless parts of Ibiza in the north of the island. with someone who was lucky enough to live near this very beautiful place on a cliff overlooking the sea. I am sitting with Ben Sweeney.
I was going to the University of San Francisco, actually, then. This school got shut down by the demonstrations, the Vietnam protests. They drafted me, and through a lot of work, I got my conscientious objector status. Yeah, peace and love, you know?
Man. Yeah, I know.
You know, something was really happening. The Beatles were getting turned on to the Maharishi and going to India.
On the hippie trail, it was known as, wasn't it?
Yeah, we were into the Love-Ins and Timothy Leary, hallucinatory drugs. You know, we were into psychedelics. And then I think about 68, 69, it started to change. The hard drugs started moving in, the heroin, the mafia. That was when there was the first death at Altamont at the Rolling Stones concert. And the whole vibe kind of changed. And we started traveling around. There was kind of a circle of places. London, Paris, Kabul, Goa, Formentera, you know, Ibiza.
What did you do all day, Ben? How did you fill the day?
Mostly playing music. And the full moon party experiences were indescribable. The swimming, watching the full moon rise out of the sea and the sunset. Absolutely nobody around with the fish and the dolphins, like you're saying, and indescribable experiences.
Was there any problem here when you were, would you say, a hippie? Or was there any difficulty with the authorities?
Oh, yeah, sure. But we were using a lot of drugs, you know, so. I mean, it was, actually, it's one of the things that we used to love. There was very few police. They were there, and we didn't know it until we, you know, we got busted and a lot of scenes happened.
But, of course, there were bad trips, too.
Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of recovering drug addicts. And the story was that some French hippies had an acid trip or something, got into some Satan cult or something, and dug up a couple graves in one of the cemeteries in Formentera. And that outraged everybody, so they blamed it all on the hippies.
So I bought me a ticket, I caught a plane to Spain, went to a party down a red dirt road. There were lots of pretty people there, reading Rolling Stone, reading Vogue.
I think when I moved here, I started observing the local farmers, and there was a whole group of us Americans that bought two or three houses in the area. And yeah, we had a little community. It was kind of like a commune, and we learned how to farm from them, to keep animals, and we tried to live that life.
Cesar Jerez Ferreira.
Hippies, they were living like 15, 20 people in one house, all naked and making love with each other, and you know, it was loud. Franco never bothered them. It was fantastic. Me and my mates and my friends from school, we started going out with the foreign girls, and it was great because here our friends from the school, girls, females, no way we could touch them.
You know, as long as we didn't try to get too interested in their daughters, you know, everything was okay.
And you never did that, did you?
Oh, no, not at all. We got a little interested, but then when you got in the door and saw the shotgun behind the door, you know, you kind of thought about things, you know.
Lost interest very quickly.
We laugh a lot. I've got a lot of Ibizinka friends, you know. We laugh a lot about the old days.
Our flat was in a house, a little, humble, white house on this very corner. But what have they done to the corner? We used to be able to see the boat from Barcelona come in. And the stone is as I remember it. I just can't find the place I remember. I suspect my little house is gone. The sea nymphs have changed their siren tune since the 1960s. Overnight, it seems, Ibiza became Ibiza.
Franco died in 75. The island, just like the rest of Spain, is psychologically a different place from what it was under Franco. Once they put in an international airport, it had to happen. We have planes landing here on weekends every 3 minutes, 24 hours a day. Each plane carries approximately 200 people.
When it came with the tourists was the development. Hotels, hotels, and cement, cement everywhere.
And the end of that happy childhood life.
Yeah, the water level was going down, 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 so we couldn't farm no more. And they're still building more and more and more. I don't know when they're going to finish.
It seems kind of now that people are partying, but they don't get the spiritual part of it at all. Yeah, consumerism. I mean, that's all I've been fighting for the last 30 years.
If you live out in the country, then you get away at your own pace. A lot of the changes are for the better, of course. You could never keep it forever the way it was because it was so idyllic and so marvellous. They couldn't have stayed like that. Nowhere else did. Now that it's coming to the end, you wish you could do it all over again. One can't.
I'm not as afraid for the future of paradise as I was before I went back and talked to longtime residents. Mass tourism shifts with fashion. I fancy I felt it shifting away from Ibiza already. Whatever hordes are already massing on the horizon, the Ibizencos will cope. They have a genius for hospitality. Ibiza will continue to make music travelers cannot resist.
When I left the final time, it was on a sailing boat, and I remember seeing the citadel recede and knowing that I would never be back this time. And it's the last time I wept leaving a port. Would you ever leave this island?
No way. I haven't seen a better place than here. But everything, the sea, the forest, mountains, green, safe. And the people also, if you need some help, they'll be there for you. I haven't seen it anywhere else in the world. Never leave the island. Never leave the island. Yeah.